This program is a production of Restoring the Core, an initiative designed to assist those wishing to go deeper into classic Christianity, with resources available in a connected age, online at restoringthecore.com. This is Finding Hidden Treasure, episode number 48. Today, we will be discussing the sermon entitled Thanksgiving and Prayer by Charles Spurgeon. Welcome to Finding Hidden Treasure, your weekly discussion of resources available for those looking to go deeper into classic Christianity. When we examine our Christian faith, we find that in so many ways it is counterintuitive. It is counterintuitive that God would reach humans by becoming one of us rather than letting us climb up to where He is at. It is counterintuitive that to be first, one must become the least. It is counterintuitive that the path to glory is not by exalting yourself, but by daily, in a very real sense, carrying a cross, not as a fashion accessory, but a Roman means of persecution and execution. This is done so that you will slowly put to death your sinful nature to allow Christ's life to live more and more fully within you. Giving thanks is the same kind of counterintuitive activity. In his first letter to the church in Thessalonica, the Apostle Paul instructed the believers there to give thanks in all things. That's 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 18. Please note that he said, not thankful for all things, but thankful in all things. This counterintuitive approach to gratitude was played out in my home country of the United States in the autumn of 1863. The United States was in the middle of a very bloody and costly civil war. On September 28, 1863, Sarah Hale wrote a letter to President Abraham Lincoln asking that a regional holiday of Thanksgiving celebrated in New England would be made a permanent national holiday in the United States. Lincoln would go on to issue the Thanksgiving Day Proclamation for that year to be celebrated in late November. Even amidst the horrors and carnage of that war, the American people, both Union and Confederate, needed to give thanks to God not for the war, but in the midst of the war. Since 1863, Thanksgiving has been a permanent annual holiday in the United States. On the day before Sarah Hale wrote her letter to President Lincoln, across the Atlantic Ocean, in London, at the Metropolitan Tabernacle, Charles Spurgeon preached a sermon on Psalm 65, verse 11, which reads, "Thou crownest the year with thy goodness, and thy paths drop fatness." Today, we will be discussing the sermon, Thanksgiving and Prayer, delivered on September 27, 1863, by Charles Haddon Spurgeon at the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London, England. Spurgeon opens the sermon with a hypothetical example. He writes, "Possibly objections might have been raised to a day of Thanksgiving for the abundant harvest if it had been ordered or suggested by the government. Certain brethren are so exceedingly tender in their consciences upon the point of connection between church and state that they would have thought it almost a reason for not being thankful at all if the government had recommended them to celebrate a day of public Thanksgiving." I find it interesting that Spurgeon uses this as an example. What he described was something which would, in only a matter of weeks, become a permanent feature in the United States right up to the present moment. He makes a point similar to the one that Shakespeare made in his play Othello. The character of Iago says to Rodrigo, "Sir, you are one of those that will not serve God if the devil bid you." Spurgeon feared that many he knew might not give thanks to God if even the government ordered or suggested it. In reaction to those who oppose us, if those who oppose us recommend that we do a good thing, we should still do a good thing, such as give thanks to God. Spurgeon continued, "However, none of us can feel any objection arising in our minds if it be now agreed that today we will praise our ever-bounteous Lord and, as an assembly, record our gratitude to the God of the harvest. We are probably the largest assembly of Christian people in the world, and it is well that we should set the example to the smaller churches. Doubtless, many other believers will follow in our track, and so a public thanksgiving will become general throughout the country. I hope to see every congregation in the land raising a special offering unto the Lord to be devoted either to his church, to the poor, to missions, or some other holy end. A few things here are worthy of comment. First, Spurgeon recognized a bountiful harvest in England in that year of 1863 was deserving of being accompanied by a public thanksgiving to the Lord of the harvest. In doing this, Spurgeon also recognized a responsibility which he and his congregation, London's Metropolitan Tabernacle, had to the rest of the Christian church. Their total capacity at this time was around 6,000. They were, to borrow a phrase from the 21st century, a megachurch of their time, perhaps the megachurch of their time. Spurgeon wanted his church to be a good influence on churches with smaller congregations, which meant in this case everyone else. Their desire was to be an example to other churches in ways they could show their gratitude for what God did for them. Further on in the sermon, Charles Haddon Spurgeon makes a point about the blessing of God by supernatural or natural means. He wrote, "Millions are benefited by God's once opening his liberal hand. When the Hebrews went through the desert, there were but some 2 or 3 million of them, and yet they sang sweetly of him who fed his chosen people. In our own land alone, we have 10 times the number. Have we no hallowed music for the God of the whole earth?" The point is well taken. God clearly took care of the people of Israel, whose population at the time was a tenth of the English population of 1863. If God took care of a smaller group, and he was praised by them, how much more so is God deserving of praise in caring for a larger nation? Spurgeon continued, "Let us not despise the bounty of God because this great boon, that is, the abundant harvest of 1863, comes in a natural way. If every morning when we awoke we saw fresh loaves of bread put into our cupboard, or the morning's meal set out upon the table, we should think it a miracle. But if our God blesses our own exertions and prospers our own toil to the same end, is it not equally as much a ground for praising and blessing his name? Do we think that God is somehow not worthy of our thanks if the benefit which we receive comes to us by natural rather than by supernatural means? Perhaps we fall into a mental or spiritual trap of thinking that things which come to us by natural means didn't really have God behind it. There is a rather corny joke which makes the point. It is about a man who was trapped on the roof of his house during a worsening flash flood. He prayed that God would deliver him as the flood waters rose. A police rowboat, then a motorboat, and then a helicopter were successfully turned away by the man as he continued to look to God for deliverance in the flood. When the flood rose and the man drowned, the man who is now in heaven asked God, "Why didn't you deliver me, Lord?" And God replied, "I sent you a rowboat, a motorboat, and a helicopter. Why did you refuse them?" Customarily, thanksgiving has included prayer in the form of praise to God. In developing a number of themes around the concept of harvest, one theme concerns the role of prayer. In this, Spurgeon writes, "Beloved, the Lord has other paths besides those of the open means of grace, and these too drop fatness. Especially, let me mention to you the path of prayer. No believer ever says, 'My leanness, woe unto me,' who is much in the closet. Starving souls generally live at a distance from the mercy seat." Spurgeon here makes an allusion to the Ark of the Covenant, and on top of it, that which is referred to as the mercy seat. The Ark of the Covenant was a kind of portable throne for God in Israel. Spurgeon's point was that no believer who is much in the closet, and that's his way of referring to one who's in private prayer, done in one's closet or inner room, will ever be a starving soul. Spurgeon continues, "Close access to God in wrestling prayer is sure to make the believer strong, if not happy. The nearest place to the gate of heaven is the throne of the heavenly grace. Much alone, and you will have much assurance. Little alone with God, your religion will be very shallow. You shall have many doubts and fears, and but little of the joy of the Lord. Let us see to it, beloved, that since the soul-enriching path of prayer is open to the very weakest saint, since no high attainments are required, since you are not bidden to come because you are an advanced saint, but freely invited, if you be a saint at all. Let us see to it, I say, that we be often in the way of private devotion, be much on your knees, for so Elijah drew the rain upon the famished Israel fields. Spurgeon's observation is simple, profound, and comforting. The ones who will sense God's joy will be with him often in prayer. To do this doesn't require theological degrees or some form of advanced credentials. Simply be a Christian. Simply be a saint who is in Christ, and this soul-enriching life is available to you. One aspect of gratitude is understanding that God has truly acted on your benefit and that you can see how God's blessing on you has been a blessing to others. Spurgeon writes, "Here it is, O well-beloved flock of my care and love, that I ask your gratitude, mainly and chiefly. My brethren, how the Lord has cheered and comforted our hearts while he has crowned our years with his goodness. Here these 10 years have I, as he has enabled me, preached the gospel among you. We have seen no excitement, no stirrings of an unwarranted fanaticism, no wildfires have been kindled, and yet see how the multitude have listened to the gospel with unceasing attention. And the surging crowds at yonder doors prove that, as in the days of John the Baptist, so it is now. The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and every man presses into it. As for conversions, has not the Lord been pleased to give them to us as constantly as the sun rises in his place? Scarce a sermon without the benediction of the Most High, many of them preached in weakness, which none of you have known but the speaker. Preached at times with throbs of heart and partings of anguish, which have made the preacher go home mourning that he ever preached at all. And yet success has come, and souls have been saved, and the preacher's heart has been made to sing for joy. For the seed rots not, the furrows are good, the field has been well prepared, and where the seed falls, it brings forth 100-fold to the praise and honor of the Most High. Brethren, we must not forget this. We might have preached for naught. We might have plowed the thankless rock and gathered no sheaves. Why then does he bless us? Is it our worthiness? Ah, no. Is it for aught or for anything, in the preacher or in the hearers? God forbid that we should think such a thing. It has been the sovereign mercy of God which has prospered his own truth among us. And shall we not for this praise and bless his name?" At the time of this sermon being preached, Spurgeon had been with his congregation for about 10 years. He saw the remarkable things that were happening at the Metropolitan Tabernacle. Gratitude gives us the lens to see life rightly. While God works through our actions, it is not our actions on their own which bring about the benefit to others. It is the blessing of God which causes this. Spurgeon knew this. His gratitude for what God had done in their midst is seen clearly to be from God's hand and not their own. This is a good reminder for us, especially in our efforts at Christian service. We work, but it is God who blesses and enables the work. I will be providing a link to this sermon on the Restoring the Core website for this episode. Spurgeon knew that true gratitude will bring a response. When we realize what we have been given, we will normally desire to act on those blessings. We find this in Charles Spurgeon's closing words of this sermon. And lastly, would it not be well for us if the Lord would crown this year with his goodness by making us begin from this day to be more prayerful? Let our prayer meetings have more at them, and let everyone in his closet pray more for the preacher, pray more for the church. Let us, every one of us, give our hearts anew to Christ. What say you today to renew your consecration vow? Let us say to him, "Here, Lord, I give myself away to thee once more. Thou hast bought me with thy blood. Accept me over again. From this good hour, I will begin a new life for a second time, if thy spirit be with me." help me, Lord, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Happy Thanksgiving Day. Thank you for listening to this program. We can be contacted at mail@restoringthecore.com. We're on Facebook at www.facebook.com/restoringthecore. You can also follow us on Twitter at @RestoreTheCore. My original blog is still active and can be found at schoolofthesolitaryplace.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. We hope you will join us next time for Finding Hidden Treasure.